From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Ted Turner is many things to many people. Founder of CNN, owner of the Atlanta Braves, world-class sailor, and general loudmouth. But one thing Turner has quietly focused on in the last decade is being more of an eco-capitalist, specifically reintroducing the North American bison to the Western Plains.
Todd Wilkinson is the author of Last Stand, Ted Turner's Quest to Save a Troubled Planet. In it, he chronicles Turner's efforts and challenges to not only reestablish bison on his 107,000-acre ranch in Montana, but also elk, bear, and wolves as well. Much to the annoyance of his neighbors and the local cattle ranchers.
That's right. Todd Wilkinson joins us in the first part of the show. Then in the second half, we'll speak with Richard Heinberg, author and senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute, a nonprofit organization which considers economies and lifestyles that are less dependent on fossil fuels.
Among other things, Heinberg suggests that climate change cannot be solved unless we rethink and change our perspectives and definitions of global economies and economic growth.
Our best hope for a livable planet, Heinberg argues, will require equal measures of population control, improved management of all natural resources, including fossil fuels, and recognition that economic growth, as defined by economists, is not sustainable.
You can join in on the conversation today by posting to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth, or emailing us at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org, and we will pass your questions on to our guests.
Our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Patty Wells, Associate Broker, Summit Sotheby's, WellsProperties.com, Hugo Coffee, serving bulletproof coffee, Nitro, Paleo, gluten-free items daily, Joel Fine, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, JustCallJoel.com, 901-2171, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
This is Dana Edwards on behalf of Vail Resorts and Cannons Resort supporting KPCW. This year, we developed partnerships with 25 local nonprofits to support programs like the fourth grade program at Swanner Preserve and Eco Center. Every fourth grader in Summit County will experience Utah's ecosystem firsthand and see science come to life through infield classes. Thanks to Swanner for making science cool.
Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. She's Nell Larson. I'm Chris Cherniak. Entrepreneur and media mogul Ted Turner has commanded global attention for his dramatic personality, his founding of CNN, his marriage to Jane Fonda, and his company's merger with Time Warner. But his environmental and conservation resume has gone largely ignored, even while his role as a pioneering eco-capitalist means more to Turner than any other aspect of his legacy. Todd Wilkinson chronicles Turner's environmental efforts in his book Last Stand, Ted Turner's Quest to Save a Troubled Planet. And Todd joins us on the phone. Thanks so much for taking the time to chat with Nell and me this morning, Todd.
Good morning. Pleasure to be here.
Hey, lots of things to talk about when it comes to Ted Turner, but I guess the first question Nell and I had generally is, why the Flying D and why bison?
Well, a couple of things. The Flying D is this Ponderosa-like ranch straight out of Bonanza. It is this incredible piece of property, and Utahns can appreciate the fact that it extends from the Madison River on the west side to the Gallatin on the east, you know, part of the holy trinity of fly fishing streams, and there's a lot of water that flows through it, and that attracted Ted out in the late 1980s. And as far as bison, it's a fascination that has existed with Turner going back to his childhood. Literally, though it sounds apocryphal, he carried around buffalo nickels in his pocket and dreamed of establishing a bison herd when he was growing up in the Southeast, and always thought it ironic that we would have Native Americans on one side of the nickel and bison on the other, and that here was a bit of our coinage that has two symbols that were pressed for near annihilation in the country. So it's something that goes back deep in Ted Turner's history.
So the Flying D is a huge ranch. I think we said it was somewhere around 107, 110,000 acres. That's like that's almost 150 square miles. It's huge. And
absolutely, yeah.
And he purchased that from a previous owner that raised cattle on that property, right?
Right. And it was a ranch that was owned by a group of folks from Texas, and it had been chronically overgrazed by cattle. And so how do we know that? We know that because the streams in the interior of the ranch flowing through it had become mud bogs and silted in, and there was a lot of grassland that had been overgrazed and become barren. And when Ted came in, he booted the cattle off the ranch and started replacing them with bison. And one of the outcomes that he managed for was to make sure that the water flowing through the ranches became clear and could support native trout populations. And along the way, early on, he alienated a lot of the cattle ranchers in Montana by insulting them, saying that bison were more hygienic than cattle and that they had all of these advantages. It's true that they possessed profound advantages over cattle, but the cattlemen felt insulted by those assertions.
Right.
So it's interesting to hear about this whole process, because this is a massive move, of course. This is a big jump into conservation. Were there other efforts that he had done in past years sort of leading up to this?
Yeah, that's a great question. So a couple of things. You know, he started out, he was what we would call a hook and bullet Teddy Roosevelt conservationist. He was involved with Ducks Unlimited and protecting wetlands in the southeast. He bought some properties where he liked to duck hunt. But one of the most interesting things, and I start the book out with this, is he had a property in South Carolina where he had tamed mountain lions and black bears in pens. And literally, one of them was named Boo Boo the Bear. And he had this scheme where he was going to rewild another property in Florida, and so under darkness of night, he carried the cougars and the black bears, and he thought he would rewild his property in Florida and carry them across state lines, and he turned them loose, and he was all excited about that. He didn't have any nefarious intentions. But a woman was driving along a highway, and a cougar ran out, and she hit it, and it was killed. And they traced it back to Ted and realized that it was Ted who had released these animals, which, of course, was illegal. And they said, if you ever do this again, we're going to haul you in. And Ted decided, you know, he wanted to have big enough spaces to be able to accommodate wide-ranging species, bison, but also carnivores, wolves, grizzly bears, mountain lions, where they could exist and be welcomed on his properties. And he wouldn't have to worry about them, you know, going off the property. And he wanted to do it legitimate. So he, you know, set the goal that one day he would own enough land and he could do it in the West where he could accommodate all of these species. And one of the most interesting things I find is that the Flying D, which you mentioned, today has all of the major mammal species that were there at the end of the Pleistocene. So you have the largest wolf pack in the lower 48 right in the middle of the ranch, and Ted is happy that it's there.
So with all these species being present, are these species that he brought and introduced, the wolverine, the wolf, the bear, or did some of them find this place naturally?
That's a great question. So they all found their way there naturally, with the exception of bison. And it's sort of built on the premise, if you protect it, they will come. And in the case of wolves, those were natural dispersers out of the Yellowstone reintroduction that, as you know, happened 20 years ago this winter. So grizzly bears came up the Madison Range across the Spanish Peaks onto Ted's ranch. Wolves came from Yellowstone. and wolverines came out of the mountains, as did a number of other creatures that just were absent during previous ownership when it was a cattle operation.
Right, and then going back to that, his neighbors didn't take too kindly to that allowance because those are the exact types of species, even elk, that you don't want on cattle land, correct?
Yeah, that's true, and it's another part of this is that Ted, because of state law, has to have the bison fenced in, but he also needs to have fences that can accommodate the free movement of elk across property lines. And there's an elk herd that has ranged in number anywhere between 1,400 and 2,000 animals. They're all public animals, publicly owned by citizens. And so those animals spend part of the year on Ted's ranch, eat the grass, and then they disperse onto adjacent national forest land. And I'll tell you, the hunters love it because the Flying D operates as a sort of de facto elk factory. And in particular to the Flying D, shortly after Ted purchased it, he put one of the largest conservation easements on the property, ensuring that it will never be covered and subdivided with homes. And in perpetuity, i.e. forever, he can only have five additional homes on all of it. This is a piece of property that you could fit a couple of Manhattan islands inside of it.
Right. Huge. And
yep.
So how do his neighbors take to him now? You talk in your book about the first time Ted and Jane Fonda went to the annual Cattlemen's Association dinner or so, and that was a very uneasy evening, but he gave a talk there.
Absolutely. You know, he went there and he actually gave a part mea culpa where he said, you know, I'm sorry that I've insulted you, but bison have proven that they have competitive advantages. I'm not going to harshly judge you for having cattle, but don't harshly judge me for bison. And as he's proven, you know, good fences do make good neighbors. He's really pioneered the notion of how to contain bison in these large landscapes because he has few problems with his neighbors. He has 16 bison ranches across the West, 55,000 bison in all, and he has few problems. This notion that bison are unruly and that you can't have them, mm-hmm. it's just proved to be patently false. People consider Ted Turner a good neighbor.
So how much land does he own in total in the U.S.?
He owns around 2 million acres, which makes him the second largest landowner in the country behind his dear friend, John Malone, another cable TV guy who just surpassed Ted when he bought some timberlands in Maine.
Wow.
And how has the bison population grown? Where did they start and where are they today?
Well, so when Ted started, there had never been anything like Ted Turner. He went on this buying spree, and he bought every bison that he could get his hands on in those days, and he now has a closed herd. In other words, he doesn't bring animals from outside into his herd. It's all self-perpetuating. His ranches are in Montana, South Dakota, Nebraska, which is really the heart of former bison country with right. the northern herd, Kansas. He's got three large ranches in New Mexico, then there's another piece of property in the tall grass country of Oklahoma.
Hey, if you just joined us, we're speaking with Todd Wilkinson. He's the author of Last Stand, Ted Turner's Quest to Save a Troubled Planet. It's in paperback form right now. It's a great book. Todd, so now he raises these bison, not just to let them run. I mean, this is a product for him that he markets and sells.
Yes, absolutely. So he's got two different kinds of operations with bison. One is he raises some animals that go in. He has a restaurant chain called Ted's Montana Grill, but one of the things he realized And this is something that, every good cattle rancher realizes, that you lose value on an animal as it leaves your property and ends up going towards the consumer. Ted believes in bison because they're high in omega-3 and omega-6 vitamins. They're low in fat and cholesterol. As he says, Native Americans, historically, you never found many cases of diabetes in Native Americans who ate a bison diet. And so he realized that if he's going to pay for his operations, they need to be profitable. So part of that is he raises bison for the plate, the consumer plate. I should note that Temple Grandin, the great ethologist and animal welfare person, has done an audit on all of his ranches and found them to be exemplary. Ted hasn't tried to turn bison into cattle. He wants bison to be bison, and that's why he has large landscapes. The other thing that's notable is that when he bought a ranch in New Mexico, there was this this herd of bison that came with it. And as it turns out, they were descended from animals that were in Yellowstone, and so they're genetically pure bison, one of only four or five herds in the country that are genetically pure, going back to the days when we had 35 million bison in America, and then, you know, they were nearly annihilated. And some herds have cattle genes in them, and Ted is trying to, you know, over the course of time, breed the cattle genes out. So it's interesting. Those animals he manages as a conservation herd, those genetically pure animals.
So tell us a little bit about your relationship with Ted Turner and how this book came about.
Well, I interviewed Ted Turner in 1992 for a New York magazine shortly after he had caused conflict with Montana cattle ranchers. And I went out there and interviewed him. And that first interview, it was very intense. I thought I would have an hour with him, and he came walking into the room and he said, "I'll give you 10 minutes." And it was very, it was very tense. It was, he was cocky and strapping. He was married to Jane. She was downstairs working out. And he had this reputation for really putting reporters in their place. I was much younger then. And we got through this interview. He ended up giving me more than an hour of time. And we talked about bison. And at that point, it was just this experiment. Ted, his media properties were about to go into their merger with Time Warner in a few years, but he was just in this building mode. He was just starting to build a bison herd. He was starting to buy land. He was starting to build the Atlanta Braves into a World Series contender. He was expanding his media enterprises. And a few years from then, that first interview, he gave $1 billion in support of the United Nations and then founded this other entity to eradicate nuclear weapons from the world. And so over the course of time, he started to evolve as this green thinker and this humanitarian. And at first, you know, the thought was that he was just this fly-by-night philanthropist, bison hobbyist, but he really started to evolve. And part of that is a reflection of with whom he consulted. And so I started the book about 9 years ago, writing it, and it was just to look at what happened to Ted Turner. Was he the real deal or not? And so what I set out to do was write an adventure story that features Ted Turner as this character in it, but it really speaks to a bunch of issues, the major threats facing us in the United States and the world.
Hey, you know, we only have a few minutes left, Todd, but I do want to spend a little bit talking about his relationship with Jacques Cousteau. He was really a great admirer of Cousteau, and Cousteau was an admirer of Turner. Talk a little bit about that relationship and how they benefited from one benefited from that.
When Ted was a young man, age 24, his own father took his own life, and it left this. It traumatized Ted Turner. And Cousteau emerged as this father figure, this unlikely father figure for Ted. They were introduced to each other by the late singer John Denver, and Ted invested in Cousteau to bring his original programming, his documentaries, to TBS, and they went to the Amazon. Ted brought his sons down to meet Cousteau as he was making a documentary, and he laid out this litany of environmental problems that he was seeing related to fresh water and the oceans. And Turner said, "Gee, Captain, I came down here to be inspired, and you bummed me out." And Cousteau said, "Ted Turner, you are a media person. You're able to reach and educate millions of people, and I'm counting on you to do it." And Turner was sort of crestfallen. He said, "You know, why bother?" And Cousteau said, "But, you know, what can people of good conscience do? But if they know the world's going to end, fight to prevent that inevitability." And then a decade later, Cousteau was nearing the end of his life, and he had given up hope. He had become cynical. And the people around them watched Ted Turner rally Jacques Cousteau, and as Cousteau's eldest and last surviving son said, he said, "Ted Turner had become this guy who had surpassed the master who had taught him to become an environmentalist and had taken up the mantle." And so it's this story of transference in a big way of Ted Turner being the pupil of Jacques Cousteau and then ultimately rallying the master to fight on.
Yeah, it's a great story, and it's all chronicled in your book there, Todd. Ted Turner, the book is called Last Stand, Ted Turner's Quest to Save a Troubled Planet. We had a listener write in that says that right now there's a traveling art exhibition on the bison at the Park City Museum, and it talks about Ted's herd there. So for locals who want to learn more about Ted's bison and the Flying D Ranch, etc., they can go down to the Park City Museum. One other question from a listener is kind of interesting. It says Native Americans used every part of the bison. Does Ted do anything similar to that?
Well, Ted doesn't personally. He uses an outfit in Denver that does use every part of it. It's not in a way that Native Americans would use it for tools, but every bit of the bison is used. And one interesting thing is that the coats of bison are being used to make sweaters and things as fine as cashmere. It's this emerging thing. And I should note that the irony in all of this is that Ted, if he had his druthers, would not want any bison to die. He used to be a hunter, but he doesn't like the fact that animals die.
Right. Well, I tell you what, Todd, we got to run. Do you have a website that people can go to and learn more about your other work?
I have a website. It's ToddWilkinsonWriter.com.
Perfect. And again, the name of the book is Last Stand, Ted Turner's Quest to Save a Troubled Planet. Todd Wilkinson is the author. And hey, next time you see Ted, tell him that Park City needs a Ted's Montana Grill.
Will do. You guys keep this up. It's my favorite station in Utah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Todd. Hey, we'll leave it on that. We'll talk to you soon again, Todd.
All right. Thanks for having me.
All right. Let's take a break for some underwriters. And when we come back, Richard Heinberg from the Post Carbon Institute. You're listening to This Green Earth on KPCW, Park City.
This is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties, formerly Prudential Utah. We have been helping locals and visitors with their real estate needs since 1976 and are proud supporters of KPCW. More information can be found at bhhsutah.com or at one of our 14 offices throughout Park City.
Support for KPCW comes from X Mission Internet, now celebrating 20 years in business. X Mission offers upgraded business email hosting, including document sharing and mobile access. Details at xmission.com.
Hi, this is John with Park City Nursery.
And this is Kay with the Park City Tree Ranch.
Supporting KPCW since 1983.
Between the two locations, we carry a variety of products to help your yard and garden flourish, including living plants, yard art, seeds, bark, compost, and organic products. Park City Nursery. We know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues, concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. She's Nell Larson. Joining us on the phone is Richard Heinberg. He's an author and senior fellow with the Post Carbon Institute. He's here to talk to us about perhaps a future that's more sustainable, involving less carbon, less fossil fuels, a better management of natural resources as a whole, and perhaps rethinking economic growth, quote unquote, as economists now define it. Richard, thanks for joining Nell and me this morning on This Green Earth.
Yeah, good to be with you both.
Hey, let's give a little start with a little basic background. Who is the Post Carbon Institute, and what is the mission of PCI?
Post Carbon Institute is a nonprofit think tank. We've been around since 2003, and as our name implies, we look at the transition between our fossil fueled economy and the renewable energy future, and what that's going to imply to our economy, our way of life, and of course, to the natural world around us. We see the energy transition as a very big deal indeed. This is going to be one of the great transformations and transitions of human history, depending on how it plays out. I mean, if we invest wisely and develop renewable energy quickly, the results could be very good. Life will be different, but it will be better in many ways. On the other hand, if we drag our feet and rely on fossil fuels to the bitter end, we'll have a shattered economy and a blasted environment. not a very happy choice.
Right. Right. Now, you were in Utah last month or so, and gave a talk at a conference called the Living with Less Conference, hosted down at Utah Valley University. Can you talk a little bit about what that talk was about?
Sure. What I was explaining was my view and the view of an increasing number of economists that the kind of economic growth that we saw in the latter part of the 20th century is coming to an end. It's basically already ended in some countries. Japan is seeing its economy contract. In other countries like the United States and Europe, we've maintained economic growth the last few years through extraordinary measures like quantitative easing and massive government deficits. But the reason that economic growth is coming to an end is it doesn't have to do with just money. It's also the fact that we've created really an impossibility. We've come to rely on constant economic growth using ever more energy and materials, but we live in a finite planet, and so inevitably, as we deplete fossil fuels, as we deplete minerals and metals, commodity prices are going to rise, and that's exactly what's happened over the course of the last 10 years. And that's choking off economic growth all around the world. We don't have to have a growing economy to have a way of life that supports us and serves us. But we got used to that idea during the 20th century as a result of having cheap, abundant fossil fuels, which drove economic growth as never before in human history, and as probably will never happen again in our future. It was a one-time event. We found buried treasure, and we burned it as fast as we could. The results are catastrophic for the environment, and also for our economy, if we don't transition to a more sustainable, steady-state economy instead of expecting more of the same.
So tell us what this future economy might look like if it doesn't look like what it looks like today.
Yeah.
You know, if it's not right. as resource-based or resource-intensive, what does a sustainable economy look like?
Well, a sustainable economy is going to feature much lower energy consumption. It's also going to be much less dependent on the financial sector. Especially in this country, we've seen the financial sector balloon over the last two or three decades. Economists call this financialization. And, of course, that only happens because of the ballooning of debt and the assumption that all of that debt can be repaid with interest. But in a steady-state economy, one that's not rapidly growing, you can't anticipate high returns on investments. So we have to look for an economy in which there's much less economic inequality and in which there's generally less speculative investment. Also, it's an economy in which we recycle and reuse just about everything. During the 20th century, we developed a consumer economy. The problem in the early 20th century was overproduction. With cheap fossil fuels, we could make stuff faster than people were accustomed to buying things. And we solved that with advertising, talking people into wanting more stuff, and consumer credit, helping people go into debt to consume now and pay later. Well, as we use up the cheap, easy energy sources, fossil fuels, and as we extract more and more of the metals and minerals from Earth's crust, we're going to have to put an end to consumerism. And rather than aiming for buying more and more all the time, you know, when 9/11 happened, the president suggested our solution would be, well, go shopping, you know, support the economy. That's not going to make sense in the future. We need to conserve resources, and that means, you know, building things, whatever machines and objects and clothing and all that sort of thing that we buy is going to have to last a long time. It has to be really well made. And, you know, so as a result, we'll have better quality stuff. It's just we won't be going to the store and replacing it every week.
I'd like to think that there's probably a couple other components to that. One is like redefining a consumer economy asks me to consume less and rethink how I live my life.
That's right.
I don't need as big a home. I don't need as many cars or a boat or as many clothes, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm consuming less. I'm changing my behavior. And then the other one is population. Does population
right.
play a role? So how do you talk about a little more about those two elements?
Well, you know, we've developed certain ideals over the course of the last few decades. You know, our grandparents and great-grandparents were used to saving and mending. You know, if they had a hole in their socks, they'd get out the darning kit. And with consumerism, that kind of ethic went by the wayside, and we began to idolize a conspicuous consumption. People who, you know, the Donald Trumps of the world, who had millions and billions of dollars and multiple yachts and private jets, those were our heroes. You know, in the future, we're going to have to develop, and many of us already are doing this, develop a very different ethic where our heroes are people who consume very little but live lives that are rich in ideas, in culture, and in service. And, you know, if you look back in history, those were the traditional heroes. Those were the people that we looked up to. And that's where, in many ways, we just need to get back to normal in terms of our cultural ideals and the way we're living. You mentioned population. That's very important. You know, if the economy ceases growing but population continues to expand, that's going to be a very bad situation because there will be less and less per capita to go around. So we really need to take population very seriously, both nationally and internationally. And again, this is a cultural subject. If we develop the cultural attitude that small families and non-reproduction are ideals, then that's really going to help the transition, and we'll be much better off for it.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with Richard Heinberg. He's author and senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute. It's a nonprofit organization which considers economies and lifestyles that, among other things, are less dependent on fossil fuels. So we got a question from a listener, and they want to know that if indeed we're kind of running out of fossil fuels, whether it's coal, natural gas, and oil, why is oil, or why has the price of oil dropped to less than, in some cases, less than $80 a barrel? What's going on there?
Right. Well, first of all, this is still, from a historic point of view, a very high oil price, mm-hmm. Much higher than any agency was forecasting for, the 2014-2015 range. You know, if you look back 10, 15 years ago, nobody was forecasting we'd be paying this much. They thought we'd be paying $30 or $40 a barrel. So we still have very high prices. The reason the price has dropped is that we still have increasing production from the tight oil regions in the U.S., the Bakken play in North Dakota, the Eagle Ford play in South Texas. And meanwhile, Saudi Arabia is trying to increase its market share by driving down prices and thereby create more demand for oil in Europe. And meanwhile, many of its competitors are seeing their production stall out and decline. So it's a complicated situation, but I wouldn't read too much into it in terms of long-term trends.
Okay, and meanwhile, the cost of extracting fossil fuels continues to grow. So just because the price comes down doesn't mean the cost of extracting oil is coming down. That continues to go up.
That's an excellent point. Douglas Westwood, which is an energy consulting firm, estimates that the cost of producing oil is increasing at about 11% per year across the board. So what we're going to see over the next few months is a lot of producers being shaken out of the market. Right. And I think this is going to be particularly true of the fracking companies, the smaller oil companies that specialize in horizontal drilling and hydrofracturing, because their cost of production is in many cases, not all cases, but in many cases higher than the current oil price.
So switching gears a little bit, I have to ask what you think about the recent agreement that Obama brokered with China on carbon. What are your thoughts on this? Is this a really meaningful agreement? What does it mean for the U.S.?
Well, you know, it's you can look at it from a glass half empty or a glass half full perspective. From the more optimistic perspective, it's great that finally these two countries that are the two biggest fossil fuel emitters have come to some sort of agreement. And so what's in the interest of these two countries? Why have they negotiated this? Well, from the Chinese standpoint, I've had some discussions with someone I can't name who was actually involved in working in China to help, you know, work them through this process. And he tells me that behind the scenes, that the Chinese were overestimating their future emissions in every way they possibly could. so that when they came to the bargaining table, they could bargain down to basically business as usual. So the Chinese carbon emissions would have peaked and started to decline before 2030 in any case, with or without policy. So they haven't really agreed to that much. However, the U.S. gets something from this in the sense that, particularly the Obama administration, in that the critics of climate agreements have in the U.S. have always said, well, why should we reduce our emissions and take on some kind of economic hardship if China, which is the world's biggest emitter, isn't doing anything? Well, now that China has agreed to do something, that argument sort of falls by the wayside. So it's a start, mm-hmm. but it's certainly not nearly enough to actually turn the situation around. We need much deeper cuts, and cuts that come much sooner if we're actually going to avert catastrophic climate change.
Well, along those lines, there's an interesting article in the New York Times today about India and India's love affair, let's say, with coal. But actually, that's all they have. They don't have much in the way of oil, natural gas. All they have is coal. So they'd like to do an all-of-the-above strategy, but all they have is coal. And they are mining coal at prodigious rates, and they are building coal-fired power plants. And this article basically says that's the game changer. If India continues to move forward with its coal burning, it doesn't matter what the U.S. or China do.
Right. Well, I wouldn't put it in quite those extreme terms. China is mining and burning. I think I haven't seen the latest figures, but at least twice as much coal as India. So it's what China does really does matter. Mm-hmm. But you're right. India's coal consumption is increasing rapidly. The Indians and the Chinese really need to understand that coal is also a depleting fossil fuel, and if they build an economy relying on coal, they're essentially building an infrastructure that's dependent on a fuel that's going to become more expensive. It's going to go away, and the more they burn, more of it that they burn, the worse their economy is going to be, because it's it's a terrible problem already in Chinese cities.
Right.
The air pollution, and it's legendary. The same thing is happening in India. You can't build a sustainable economy on coal. It just can't be done. And the sooner they realize that, the better off they're going to be.
Right. But at the same time, the Indian political structure will say, hey, we're trying to get electricity to 300 right. to 400 million people in our country. You know, we're just trying to get people out of poverty and provide an infrastructure that sets the stage for improving our economy. And this is how we have to do it. And,
right.
So it's a tough argument to have to tell them to say, you gotta wean yourself off coal and rely on solar or wind or some other renewables.
I know. It is a tough one, but one way or another, the less industrialized countries are going to have to leapfrog this fossil fuel moment that the industrialized countries are going through. For two just compelling reasons. One is climate change, and the other is the fact that these fuels are finite in quantity, and becoming dependent on them over the long term has terrible economic consequences.
Right, and environmental consequences, you say.
So we have a couple of minutes left, and Richard, I want to ask you, what's next? If you could look into your crystal ball, when do you see the U.S. getting to this sustainable economy, and what do you see the next steps being?
Well, frankly, I think the road to a sustainable economy is going to be a bumpy one. We've taken some really bad steps in the last few years with our all-of-the-above energy policy. You know, fracking has given the U.S. some promise of energy independence, so a lot of people look on it as a good thing, but it's really derailed our energy policy. For better or worse, the fracking bubble is going to burst within the next 2-3 years, and that's for both tight oil and shale gas. The decline rates per well are so high, there is simply no way they're going to be able to continue drilling fast enough. They're going to run out of good drilling sites, and more analysts are coming to this conclusion. We've done in-depth analysis at Post Carbon Institute, and you can read that at shalebubble.org. I think that's going to force the question as to, you know, how and how quickly we adapt. We don't have more of the same in the future. We're not going to be exporting LNG, liquefied natural gas. We're not going to be energy independent unless we reduce our consumption of fossil fuels and start to transition to renewables.
Well, speaking of the bumpy road, the Senate's going to take a step in that direction when they vote on the XL pipeline today.
Right. Yeah, and of course, what happens then is we'll see whether President Obama will approve that or veto it, and that's going to be a big litmus test.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I anticipate him saying, "I'm not signing anything, a bill, until the pipeline route has been finalized," because it's still up in the air in the state of Nebraska. I mean, it's in the courts.
Right.
And until that decision has been decided, this Nebraska Supreme Court decides on who should really make the decision on the pipeline, the governor or the Public Service Commission, until all that is settled, he's not going to make it a decision. Now, this is just going to come back on his desk January, you know, the day that the Senate becomes a Republican majority, that same bill will come back to his desk, and then he's going to have to come up. He's just going to have to, you know, make a similar decision along those lines. But it'll just keep coming back at him.
That's right.
So, it's a really interesting, you know, situation as well. And I also read that Canada, although this country does not allow the export of crude oil, it does allow the export of other countries' crude oil. So if Canada sends its tar sands through the XL pipeline down to Houston, the refineries there can keep it as a crude oil and re-export it to other countries. So,
right. And of course, the U.S. can also export refined products.
Yes, they can export gas and diesel once that crude is refined. But it is an interesting play that Canada says, no, we're not going to export this crude oil, but, you know, we're trying to trust.
When there's a buck to be made, where there's a will, there's a way.
The market decides whether or not they will export crude oil. Hey, Richard Heimer, we have to run. We really appreciate you taking the time to chat. Was again the website for Post Carbon Institute?
I'd recommend folks go to resilience.org. That's the site that we run that's updated daily with all kinds of really interesting articles about our transition away from fossil fuels and all the implications of that.
Excellent. Resilience.org. Do you have a website yourself that you blog and write?
My stuff is at richardheinberg.com.
Perfect.
Simple Easy enough.
Hey, thanks again for joining us this morning, Richard, and we'll be back in touch.
It was a pleasure. Thanks.
Okay. Hey, let's take a break for some underwriters. When we come back, we've got a news item or two, a calendar event thing. We'll come up with something. No, I'm kidding. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
Rocky Mountain Power is proud to support KPCW and This Green Earth. Rocky Mountain Power Watt Smart New Homes Program offers incentives for building a new energy-efficient home that can help you enjoy year-round comfort, higher resale value, and lower energy bills. To learn more or find a builder in your area, wattsmart.com.
Hi, I'm Maren Mullen, and I'm a Recycle Utah board member. Did you know that water conservation is what we're really all about? And you thought it was only recycling. We save your H2O. How? By encouraging you to recycle more, by teaching our students how to conserve water, and by making it possible for you to drop off hazardous waste at our collection events. Yep, we're all about saving your water, because we can't live without it. Recycle Utah is a nonprofit organization bringing conservation ideas to you since 1990. Check us out at recycleutah.org.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. We've got a few more minutes. We wanted to get in a exhibit going on at Swana right now.
Yeah, we've got, you know, there's bison at the Park City Museum, and there's mountain lions at Swana.
There's a squirrel at my place that's driving me bananas.
You'll get your fill of wildlife.
But what do you have?
Yeah, so... it's the first traveling exhibit that we've brought to Swana. So for those of you who are familiar with the exhibits that we've had in the Eco Center since the Eco Center first opened, those have all been removed, and the entire exhibit hall is now dedicated to an exhibit on cougars. And so there are a couple of really cool, very like-life dioramas. There's an interactive panel where you can listen to different sounds they make. There's Native American art. There are some artifacts. There's some funny popular culture stuff, looking at how mountain lions have been portrayed or cougars over the years. So,
how many different names does this animal have?
You know, I read an article that said that there are over 40 different names in North America alone that have been used. The common ones, though, are cougar, puma, and mountain lion.
Cougar, puma.
Mm-hmm.
Where it might be referred to as a puma? Do you know?
I've heard it referred to as a puma is in South America, actually.
South America. Okay. So the Southwest may have pumas.
Right.
And then in Florida, it's the panther. Right. That's what Ted Turner. Todd called it a cougar, but in Florida, the Florida panther.
There is a small population of Florida panthers as well.
And then in New England, I heard them referred to as catamounts.
Yeah, same thing. Same catamounts, thing. Yep. And so what's interesting is that cougars or mountain lions have been extirpated essentially like east of the Mississippi, with the exception of a small population in Florida that's still surviving.
Wow.
And so, but the range is expanding. So where people let them, I think that cougars will continue to kind of expand back, because there are now sightings, you know, not populations per se, but sightings that are being seen outside of what we consider their population range.
We got 1 minute. Where's the nearest sightings around here?
Oh, we've got them all over town.
What?
Pinebrook, Kimball Junction, yeah. So watch out while you're on the trails. Keep an eye out. Maybe you'll get to see one.
Are you serious?
I'm serious, yeah. And you can post, if you have a sighting, come to the Swana Eco Center and post it on our board. We're kind of gathering and cataloging sightings from this area.
That's great.
Yeah.
Citizen science at work.
Yeah, exactly.
That's fantastic. Get out there, everybody. And start looking for cougar slash puma slash catamount. Okay, so that's all going on at the Swana.
That's right. We have expanded hours on Thursday nights and Sunday afternoons now.
All right, one more break for some underwriters and sponsors. We'll be back to wrap up this Green Earth.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Hey, it's time to wrap things up on This Green Earth. Let's thank our sponsors and underwriters who make this show possible. They include Recycle Utah, Republic Services, Vail Resorts, Rocky Mountain Power, San Francisco Design, and Berkshire Hathaway Home Services.
One more thing I want to mention is next week's guest, the author Diane Ackerman, will be speaking about her book, The Human Age, The World Shaped by Us.
Perfect. Great. Stay tuned for that. And again, you can always like us on Facebook at KPCW This Green Earth.
That's right. And we would love to hear from you about your ideas for future show and your thoughts at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
All right. Great show again. Todd Wilkinson, author of Last Stand, a book about Ted Turner and Richard Heinberger from the Post Carbon Institute. And remember, this is KPCW 91.9 FM, Park City.
Only in Park City, only on KPCW.
NPR News is next.